It's been over 50 years since media theorist Marshall McLuhan said that first we shape our tools and then our tools shape us. McLuhan had pushback as folks wondered at the time if what he was saying was true. The time has proven McLuhan's theory to be correct. Now that we've hit the 10-year anniversary of the launch of the iPhone, we're beginning to see how much our smartphones are shaping and changing our lives. How do our devices shape our beliefs and behaviors? What do they reflect about what's most important in our lives? And how can we use these magnificent tools to the glory of God rather than in ways that are destructive? We'll be talking to Tony Renke, author of the new book, 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You, about this and much more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, it's another day and another episode of Youth Culture Matters. Actually, more accurately, another week, I guess, is what we're supposed to say. How would you say that, Jason?
Or another episode.
Or you wouldn't say it. Yeah, another episode
of
Youth Culture Matters.
Yeah, I wouldn't say. Maybe right. Not be constrained by time.
So we don't have an actual release schedule.
Right. But we are hit right in the middle of the summer right now. Jason, how's your summer going?
Any
exciting plans?
I'm just hoping to get to a writing sabbatical that may or may not happen. So we'll see.
This is the story every single summer, a stack of books, a stack of things to do, rest, relaxation, and you just don't get through it. So it's that way for all of us.
Well, the one thing that happens every summer is I backpack and I get a solo hike and I'm getting ready to do that. So I'm pretty excited.
That'll be good. And you know, most people don't know this, but you had an encounter once, a standoff with, what was it, a mountain lion?
A mountain lion. I've engaged with just about every animal you could think of in the Pacific Northwest. So moose, grizzly bear, black bear, mountain lion. But the mountain lion, I did face off. It was 4 in the morning. I was trying to, I needed to hike 20 miles and be out by noon. And beyond my wildest fears, I got out of my tent, packed up, and came down to where we had our food, because you can't leave your food in a separate place. And there was an actual mountain lion that was down by where the food was, and pretty crazy.
Yeah, those encounters with animals, they are frightening, and I've been there, because just last week, Lisa and I were eating dinner on our patio. And there's a bush over at the end, and we heard a little bit of a rustle in the bush. And there was, there's a nest in there of baby robins. And the mother robin was a little upset trying to bring the worm in because we were so close to the nest. And it got hairy.
Mountain lion. They're,
it got very hairy.
Yeah, they're pretty much the same.
Yeah, that can be pretty scary.
Hey, you ever have your eye pecked at by a robin?
Nope.
I never have either, but it almost happened. I think we were close. It was frightening.
Have you ever been dragged by the neck by a mountain lion? Well, it almost happened.
No, not that I can remember. Yeah. Yeah. I get it. I just go back to being on the patio last week eating dinner, and it's...
Could you have taken 3 steps to go inside?
Well, I like to live on the edge, and so I stayed out on the edge of the patio.
Good job.
Yeah. Why are we talking about this? What? It's summertime.
You asked about animals. I was bringing up backpacking, and then you
let's let transition our out of this to just see if
about
you guys,
my experiences what, with wildlife.
Yeah. What do you guys got for us
today?
All right.
Speaking of the dog days of summer, we've got a baseball quiz for you, too.
Okay. See, I had no clue we were going to summertime stuff and baseball.
All right.
This was a good.
Oh, this is great.
So
this is perfect.
I've tailored this for the two of you. I'm just going to throw out some names of baseball players. I tried to pick ones that would be contemporary, ones that you would have grown up watching from your favorite teams.
Who growing up? Which one of us? Because we're two different generations.
Yes, you'll see the names here.
One of us is not yet grown up.
So it's just simply going to be a Price is Right type scenario, but you're not guessing on the same thing. You're guessing on the player that I say for you. So you're going to tell me how many career home runs.
Oh my!
And their career batting average, and okay. It's Price is Right style. So it's the closest without going over.
Oh, that's great.
All right, I like this. So it's baseball stats. So here we go for you. And there's you each have two players. So, Jason, your first one, and I'll let you think about him for a second. No Googling. Jason, Andre Dawson. I picked Cubs players for you.
Yeah, Andre Dawson.
Career home runs, career batting average.
Uh-huh.
And Walt, for you, we'll start with Mike Schmidt. Career home runs, career batting average.
I love Mike Schmidt. Yeah, that's good. I could have done either of these.
All righty.
Okay, Andre Dawson. Man. Home runs average.
What was his nickname? I'm trying to remember. Wasn't he like, he had a nickname, Andre Dawson. What was his nickname?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not.
Google that, Kenton. Andre Dawson's nickname. So,
all right. Go, you got some answers?
And it's career home runs?
Career home runs. Not just with the Cubs or anything like that.
Yep.
Career home runs.
The nickname was the Hawk.
That's it, the Hawk. I knew it was a bird. Hawk. I couldn't.
There's a hawk. There's a bird to actually maybe be afraid of.
Yeah.
Or he did have a second one.
Okay.
Was the Awesome Dawson.
That's not it. Yeah.
No.
There's two.
No, it was the Hawk.
Okay. I remember the Hawk.
All right, Jason, you want to guess Dawson, career home
Andre
runs?
Andre Dawson. So home runs. I'm guessing over a career 380.
Okay. And batting average.
275. He had a bit of a strikeout rate.
All right. You're gonna see your math brilliance or lack thereof.
Actually, can I change that? I do want to change that.
I think you locked in.
Why are you looking
at your phone?
I'm not looking at my phone. I'm not. I am going to change it to 268.
268. Okay. All righty.
268, because I'm kind of computing stuff in my head. So 268. All right. Mike Schmidt.
All right. So this is interesting. You originally guessed Dawson's batting average at 275, right? And that's what I wrote for Schmidt.
Okay. 275, okay.
Yep. Yeah. And then the home runs, I know he hit over 500. I can't remember if he hit up to 550. Something tells me it was around 530 or 47. Am I allowed to guess without going over? Is there that rule? Whatever's close. Okay, I'll say.
You can't. If you go over, you can't go over. You lose.
Oh, really?
You can't go over. It's an automatic loss if you go over.
All right. Price is Right style. 525 for the home runs.
All righty. So for the first player, Walt wins in the home run category. Mike Schmidt hit 548 career home runs, so Walt was 23 under.
I was good. I have written down here 550, and I would have lost.
You would have lost.
You would have lost.
Yeah, even though I was two off.
And Andre Dawson hit 438, so Jason guessed 380, so he was 58 under. So Walt wins the career home run category. Andre Dawson had a career batting average of 279, so you were actually really close with your first guess at 275. Yeah. But even with the 268, you still win because Mike Schmidt was only a 267 career hitter. So Walt was over on that with his 275.
All right.
Each of you get one more player.
Okay, this is good.
Now, this is good we're doing this. This is fun. This is the kind of thing I guess you have to be a baseball fan, but choose any sport. And if you've got kids who've got an interest in sport, throw this stuff out there. This would be great father-son, mother-daughter.
And take the time to tailor it to the audience. I picked Phillies players and Cubs players, respectively, for Walt and Jason, because that's, they're where their interest lies.
Yeah.
All right. Your next player, this could have been used for both of you, but it's going Jason's way. Ryan Sandberg.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
And Walt, I'll choose for you Dick Allen.
Oh, you know.
So, again, career home runs and career batting average.
Okay, now, he used to be called Richie, and he was one of my favorite players, number 15.
That's what I picked. I picked it for you.
Not in the Hall of Fame. Are you aware of that?
I couldn't have told you that, no.
Yeah. I don't think he's in the Hall. Check that. Google that, Kenton. I think he's one that they've tried to get in, but he's not in. And our buddy Greg gave me two nice, asked me once who my favorite player was as a kid and gave me two nice big autographed pictures of him, one in a Phillies uniform, one in a White Sox uniform.
Mm.
Rookie of the Year, 1964.
And you would have been, you were 8 or 9?
8 years old. Yeah.
Wow.
Richie Allen. Played third base at the time. All right, so we've got silence. You
right,
go ahead.
Yep.
I didn't write anything down
go
yet.
Ahead. Well,
I was,
you can go first
busy.
This time.
All right, I'll just say I don't have anything written down. I'll go with I'm going to go with 270 for the batting average.
Okay.
And for the home runs, I'm going to go with 410.
Okay.
Okay, so for Ryan Sandberg, I'm going to go with 280. For the average, and 407 for home runs. I have to say this about Ryan Sandberg. I now live in the city where he grew up. He went to North Central High School. That's where my son could potentially go.
Okay.
If we don't move, and which I don't plan on, but who knows what the next 10, 12 years will be bring. But here's the deal.
This is turning
into about North Central High
Jason's
School.
Biopic.
No, I learned about North Central High School when I did a report on Ryan Sandberg in third grade, and it was the first place I visited when I came to the city.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So both of you drastically overestimated the number of career home runs. So you're both over.
What were they?
Ryan Sandberg had 282.
Okay, that's not right.
Dick Allen had 351. So you were both over, but Walt was much closer in that one there. But then for the batting average, Jason won that one again. You guessed 280. Ryan Sandberg had a career batting average of 285. And Walt, you guessed 270. Dick Allen, of these four players, is the highest career batting average of 292.
Wow.
Wow.
So you kind of scared me with that going over thing.
That is a great average. How many years did he play? How many years did he play?
That's a good question. I did briefly look at that. He played a lot more years than I expected. It was 16, 17 years.
I got
maybe,
a hunch.
Maybe
right
Kenny
now,
can find that for us.
I'm a little worried that right now we're making baseball actually more boring for people who already say it's boring. But this is the fun of baseball.
We're not doing soccer stats.
Yeah, just bear with me. This is not about baseball, yeah. Folks. This is a competition between me and Jason, and I lose again.
In soccer, you know, the Price is Right where you just guess one. That wouldn't even get you anywhere because that would be over.
Yeah.
How many career goals? One.
Right.
Nope.
Well,
zero.
It's under.
He played for 27 years, but he never scored a goal.
We're still underestimating the beauty of that sport.
It's one digit.
But we'll leave it.
Yeah.
We can. I just have to say, a 290 average over 16 years is unbelievable.
That's pretty amazing.
That is some incredible hitting.
I agree.
He's not in the Hall of Fame, is he?
Correct. He is not.
And people have argued about that. He should be in the Hall of Fame.
He is considered, from what people say, he is considered the best baseball player of all time, not in the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Oh, that makes sense. 290? That's
all right.
Amazing.
Do you have his like his page pulled up there? Because I'm gonna tell you, I know where he's from.
He played 15 years, by the way.
Okay, and where is he from?
That's still amazing.
Wampum, Pennsylvania.
You are correct. For bonus points, how old is he?
Well, let's see. 64 would be
81.
120.
Jason, you are over.
He's probably 73.
He is 75.
75. And you know that his brother played baseball as well. You know what his brother's name was? Ron. Ron Allen. Richie and Ron. Huh. Hey, we need to talk about something that's...
Yeah. From baseball to youth culture, what do you guys got today?
Let's do it.
Well, you know what? We're midsummer. And there were a couple of things that happened back in early June that we have not talked about yet that I just want to mention briefly because later on today we're going to talk about technology and some of the pitfalls of technology and some ways to use technology to the glory of God when we have a conversation about a new book called 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You by Tony Renke. Now, what I want to talk about, Jason, I just want to ask you about this, just a short conversation on each.
Yeah.
Two stories that came up. One we've talked about before, and this was the court case in Massachusetts where now 20-year-old Michelle Carter was convicted of, involuntary manslaughter. That was the verdict in this trial. In the death of her boyfriend, or then boyfriend, Conrad Roy, which was back in July, this was happened in July 2014, where he was depressed. It's now come out she was depressed. She had an eating disorder as well. A lot of this came out in the court case as they were back and forth, prosecution and defense. But anyway, long story short, Conrad Roy took his life in a parking lot, died in his pickup truck, carbon monoxide poisoning. And Michelle Carter, after he died, it was discovered on his phone that she had sent him electronically, a lot of them text messages, but there were also some phone calls, messages encouraging him, go ahead and do it. Why haven't you done it yet? What's taking you so long? I think even suggesting the manner in which that happens. Now, of course, she was arrested almost immediately. And we've talked about that, but now the trial is over and the verdict is involuntary manslaughter. Just a reminder of talking to our kids from a very young age, number one, about the power of words, number two, about the power of civility and the importance of civility and kindness and grace, treating others in a Christ-like manner. But number three, the way that we use social media or the way that we abuse social media. So I think this is a great story to use as a teachable moment and a talking point. I don't know. Have you had conversations about this, Jason?
Well, I just the one thing that I'm always aware of is what would have changed had there been face-to-face? What I'm curious about is the face-to-face conversations that happened outside of these texts, because I think when you text, you have this process that's in play that allows you to separate yourself from the situation a little bit. And so sometimes what you write in a text or on social media is not always connected to what would happen in a face-to-face conversation. There are multiple times where people will open up and say things that are completely surprising to me through text and then almost deny it when I see them in person. Refuse to speak about it. So I think finding a way to be able to communicate what we say through text should also match what we say in person and vice versa. I just think that there's a lot of potential for us as parents and then also as youth workers to be able to find ways to bring those together in such a way that they're similar, that they're not different, that they're one and the same.
Hmm. This is another example, and this is where the reason we're talking about this is, number one, it's important because it's happened, and number two, it reflects new trends, but number three, it does. I'll just reiterate this, offer talking points with our kids. So if you're a youth worker, this is the kind of story that you can throw out there on the table, pull up a YouTube video, a news report on it, grab some of what's come out in print journalism, summarize the story, lay it out before your kids, and have a conversation about ethics. You know, what are the issues here? What was happening that shouldn't be happening? What's not happening that should be happening? What was done right? What was done wrong? And then how do we follow up from that? So this is a good one for you to talk about. Let me throw a second one out there. And this
before
came,
you do, before you move on to the second one, I do think that one of the other elements that we've not discussed that does need to be a part of this discussion is mental illness. Because there, as the court case went on, what was shared really had to do with mental illness that was happening in his life and then also in her life. And then there was also the some of the issues surrounding food. I think that we just need to be able to recognize that sometimes we avoid those difficult conversations, but those are the conversations that we really need to be able to engage. Sometimes we can not feel equipped, but there are plenty of resources that allow for us to be able to engage in those conversations. And so we need to be able to be bold enough and brave enough to be able to enter into those.
Yeah. Well, here's another one that I think is worth talking about, and it came out about the same time, early June, just, you know, not that long ago, just a few weeks ago. And this is a story about Harvard University, seen by many as one of the most prestigious universities in the country, and also a place that, at least from what I'm reading lately, is a place where they pride themselves in, you know, free speech and free thought and allowing students to, you know, have diverse opinions about things. But what Harvard has done is they revoked their admission to at least 10 students for a Facebook post that they put up. I don't know the exact number of students at this point, but the news report is saying, one of the stories that I wrote, this one came out of the Boston Globe, says this: at least 10 high school seniors who were admitted to Harvard this spring had that acceptance yanked after administrators discovered deeply offensive messages and racist images they posted to a Facebook group chat. This was a group chat for incoming freshmen, the incoming class, would that be the class of 2021, who were coming in this coming fall to Harvard University. Among the students who lost their seats at Harvard is the daughter of a couple of major donors. And then also the messages, the memes that they put up and the text messages that they put up actually mocked sexual assault, according to the Boston Globe, mocked the Holocaust, mocked minorities, mocked suicide, and even there were mocking messages about child abuse. So, again, I look at this and I think, yeah, you submit a college application in which you, I guess now most people curate themselves and put their best foot forward, hoping to get into a school. A school can be selective. They don't just let anybody in. And I think it's perfectly legitimate if someone crosses a line and they say, this is not someone who we want to have in our student body, then we let them go and we rescind admissions. What do you think?
Well, the thing that I thought about with this story is I just really wonder how many people that we both knew as we were growing up that would not be allowed into a school based upon the things that they said, and that social media allows us to say things. And, they're not appropriate. And the many of the memes that were out there were not sensitive to many racial and other groups. But I really wonder as well, when you separate yourself, going back to what I talked about earlier, you're able to separate yourself from the in-person dialogue. So I think maybe there's more freedom that someone can feel to be able to express those things, which is not a good thing, but it does separate when it's face to face. And then I also wonder too, social media just allows you to say things in such a way that you might have said it with friends earlier, but no one would have known about. I think you and I had freedom to be able to make mistakes when we were younger and have others correct us because of the face-to-face interaction, and that just doesn't happen anymore, which means we've got to be more diligent as parents and as youth workers being able to communicate, hey, you need to have these things line up, but I also and good use of social media. But I just sometimes wonder if social media also then limits the opportunities that we have to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I do think that what we have to be aware of is that developmentally, it's anybody can be impulsive, right? I mean,
yes,
human beings have a propensity to be impulsive. Teenagers especially, children especially, have a propensity to be, impulsive because of where they're at in the developmental process and what's happening with them cognitively. We know that impulsivity is a mark of the adolescent stage, the adolescent years. And so I think there needs to be some grace as adults that we show towards that, but at the same time that we work to instill in our kids a heart that knows right from wrong and that will pause, you know. The Proverbs talks about the fact that our words can be quick and we can be foolish with quick words, and we need to stop and pause and think. And so to teach what it means to be wise and to pause and post wisely. We talk about that here with our Digital Kids Initiative all the time, just pausing. Adults need to do this as well. But ultimately, it's not about thinking things that are bad and not putting them out there. Really, what we should do is shoot for the heart. Obviously, we want our kids to show restraint, but shoot for the heart and get kids to see the difference between right and wrong and make good decisions based on the desires of their heart as they desire to bring honor and glory to God through the things that they do, the things that they say, and the things that they post. So, again, use this as a story to talk through this. Well, we're going to have a conversation today with someone who's written a fascinating brand new book. I think that this guy is a gift to the kingdom, a gift to parents, a gift to youth workers. Tony Reinke's written a new book published by Crossway. It's called 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. And when we come back from the break, Jason and I are going to jump right into a discussion with Tony about how he started to think about the changes that were being that were taking place in his own life as a result of his use of the phone, and then also lessons we can learn from that about how the phone is changing us and our kids. So practical and hope-filled look at that when we come back. Stick with us. We're excited to announce that one of our most popular CPYU resources of all time has just been released in an updated and revised format. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow Him, and that includes following Him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D Media Evaluation Guide and to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller, and once again, joined with my good friend Jason Sochenik. And today we are going to talk about, well, it's something really important because we carry it around with us all the time now. Our kids are carrying these things, and that's our smartphones. Jason, you have your phone on you now as we speak?
I have it beside me, but it's
off. Okay. All right. Don't look at it because you're going to add to
it. Well, I just did.
All right.
You kind of made it happen, but that's okay.
But we're going to talk about phones and how we use our phones and how our phones shape, and I would even say use us. With Tony Reinke, and Tony is the author of a brand new book, and the book is called 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You, and it's published by Crossway. It came out at the end of April, and I'm really excited about this book. I read an article in Christianity Today on this, a review of the book, and thought this is a guy we have to have on here. So, Tony, welcome.
Walt and Jason, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, the first question I want to ask you is, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to the point where you have this concern about phones and technology.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm an author and a nonprofit journalist in the Twin Cities, and I write about a lot of different things, but especially the intersection of where technology and digital media meet the Christian life. That's really sort of the sweet spot of what I do. I serve as senior writer at desiringgod.org. I live online. I work online. I've been tethered to my phone for about a decade now. I think in 4 different platforms, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and one other platform. I have like 37 years of experience now. I mean, I've just been online for those 10 years in an immersive way. And I needed to step back from that and ask myself the question, what is the phone doing to me? What's it doing to me as a husband, as a father, as a Christian, as a Christian leader, as a writer? What's good? What's bad? What needs to change? And so the book is really coming out of my experience and my reflection on what it means to live in the digital age wisely. And I don't think I do it really well yet, but this is part of my therapy. This is part of me growing towards a digital maturity that I want to see in myself.
Was there anything specifically that happened, like a tipping point for you, that got you to the point where you began to think about this? Hey, this could be an issue, or it is an issue, and I've got to deal with it.
You know, I think the thing that really concerned me was the fact that I was so immersed in the digital culture that I had never stepped back to think, what is this doing to me? I had never asked that question. It was David Wells, a theologian, which we mutually know, who rhetorically asked that question in an interview that I did with him about 3 years ago. And what I found, I mean, he's in his 70s, and he's writing serious books of theology and cultural engagement. And what I started to notice more and more in his books is that he was becoming more and more concerned with the digital age and digital technology. And so I set up an interview. I called him, talked to him on the phone, and he kept asking these – he every time I would ask him a question, he would come back with more questions at me. And so it was clear to me that there was a lot of questions that were perplexing older Christians about what the digital age was doing to us. And I had never stepped back and asked that question. So it was more like the frog in the kettle. You know, the kettle was getting hotter and hotter and the frog didn't know he was getting hotter. That's kind of what it felt like to be in the digital age for these 10 years, is that I'd been so immersed in it, I had never stepped back to actually ask the question, what's this doing to me?
And that's what's happening, I think, to all of us at some level. Is there an age group that you've seen that's more susceptible to that frog in the kettle phenomena?
You know, as soon as you pin this on millennials or teens, you go around and you just watch church or out in public, and you realize it's 50-plus-year-olds that are just as addicted to their phones as anybody else. I mean, as soon as you try to pin this on a certain age group, you realize it is really a phenomenon that's reaching all different demographics. I mean, the adoption rate of smartphones in the U.S. is about 92% for those between 18 and 25, and it's about 84% of those who are 50 and 60. So, I mean, there's an immersion that transcends demographics. And it's really a wholesale cultural issue. So as soon as you say, you know, those teens always on their phones, you realize that you look around and you see your parents, your 50-plus-year-olds, they're on their phones too. And so it's not limited to a certain age.
Yeah, we've mentioned before that Common Sense Media, a group that's done some research on, you know, average amount of screen time per day. And they've released research on tweens ages 8 to 12, teenagers ages 13 to 18. And when we hear those stats, you know, 6.5 hours, then 9 hours for teens, we tend to shake our heads as adults. They released, about a year after they released that data, research on adults and parents, and found that parents actually are spending more time engaged with their screens than our teenagers ages 13 to 18. So, yeah, you're right on there. Can I ask about how your faith intersected with this as you were going through this process? It sounds to me like, you know, Tim Challies, you're probably familiar with Tim and what he's written in The Next Story. And he says most of us function first and foremost at the level of experience. We don't take into account theory. And there's some great theory out there that is being developed right now, that's expanding quickly on the blessings and curses of technology and the way we use our devices. And he says we don't either go to the level of theology. Mm-hmm. So you were functioning primarily at the level of experience, it sounds like.
That's right.
Then you started, David Wells gets in. And by the way, he is someone, Chris and I are both reading the latest version of his book, The Courage to Be Protestant, right now, mm-hmm. which most people get angry at because it, I mean, and he's such a sweet guy. I mean, he's not a snarky, nasty guy. He's sweet. He loves the church. He loves people. He wants to see the kingdom of God grow in our lives. And, you know, he's written some great stuff there. But, you know, so he challenges you. Had you not been thinking theologically, and I'm not, you know, I'm asking you to tell your story here. It's not a criticism, but this is the way most of us live, I think.
Yeah, most of us live this way. Most of us don't think critically about what our attention is given to. And so, you know, a lot of Christians just sort of follow the culture here. They fill their eyes with what the culture offers. And what I notice over time is that the Bible puts the phrase, set your mind upon, that phrase occurs dozens and dozens of times from Genesis to Revelation, all throughout biblical revelation, because what God is reminding us is that what we set our minds on is really disclosing who we are. What grabs our attention says everything about who we are. That's what Paul talks about in Romans 8, verses 5 to 8. He's saying what grabs your eyes is what exposes who you are. And so the gospel is about setting our minds on Christ, who is our supreme treasure. That's Colossians 3. And so what I started to see is that there's a tug of war. Once the mass media age comes into being, you see this tug of war for human attention between the gospel and between those things that continually can fill up the small gaps of our lives, the smartphone being the really the greatest invention in human history when it comes to media, because what the phone can do is fill every 9-second gap of our lives with new media. So If Spurgeon, you know, the great Saint Spurgeon said, you know, when I transition from things in my day, I like to offer a little prayer between the things that I do. So he's transitioning from sermon prep to maybe going to an orphanage. He's got a little bit of time. He's going to pray in that gap. And what do we do in those little gaps is we tweet, we check Facebook, we go to Instagram, we publish a picture. So every little small crack of time that we have in our day is now filled up with this new media in a way that's really revolutionary, but it also makes us step back as Christians and think, okay, what am I giving my attention to? And what does that show about my heart?
Mm. Wow. Anybody here getting uncomfortable yet? Mm. Ken, are you all right over there?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. All right, good. Ken's our millennial here. We harass him all the time, so he's our tech guy, and I just give it to him a little bit. But you're right, it's all of us, and this is good. This is good to think this way. So let me ask you this question. How often, on average, do we check our phones every day?
Yeah, so there's different studies. One study says about 85 times a day, which is really low, I think. And there's a study that I think is more accurate. It says 220 times a day we check our phones, which is an average of 4.3 – once every 4.3 minutes of our waking day, we're checking our phone. We're impulsively grabbing for our phone. But the thing – there's an even newer study that came out in April that says really our phones are always on our brain. The study is titled Brain Drain, and what they came up with is this idea that if our phone is sitting on the table, if we can see our phone or if we can access our phone, some part of our brain is always thinking about the possibilities of what that phone can either offer us or that we can use the phone to publish. And so some part of our brain is just dedicated now to thinking of what can I use my phone for and what is my phone about to offer me through a push notification. Then what they did is the same study did another thing that said if you're trying to do really hard work, you're trying to read a long book, you're trying to do homework, you're trying to do something serious, then you've got to actually use part of your brain to actively resist your impulse towards your phone. So what this study called Brain Drain came up with is whether you're wondering about the potential of your phone or whether you're actively trying to resist your phone, some part of your brain is cognitively focused on the phone at all times. So we're always online. That's the reality. And our brains cannot focus entirely on anything anymore because our phones are close to us. And unless we can learn how to get our phones out of reach, out of sight, out of mind, some part of our brain is always thinking about our phone. And so that brings up the question that even Denzel Washington recently asked on the BBC interview that he did. What is the phone doing to us? It's a rhetorical question. What is the phone doing to us? The culture's asking this question. Pastors and parents are asking this question. And it's really time for us to open up scripture and to really think about our attention, to think about our appetites, and to really ask the hard questions of what is the phone doing to us? And even more foundational, what is our phone exposing in our hearts?
Mm. I think that's a great question because that's really what we're talking a lot about is what is the phone doing to us? You wrote an article for Christianity Today that was titled, "Your Smartphone is Neither a Cancer or a Cure-All." And it was referenced, but your book was referenced in the midst of that. Yeah. And so it was Jeff Hannon that wrote that article. I apologize. But I am curious, in the midst of that, what were some of the things that you learned? Because I think that one of the things that can actually happen is we can either treat it as a cancer or a cure-all. And what we're talking about is something in the in-between. And so I'm curious, what were some of the things that you learned in the midst of that?
Yeah, so part of the reason why I start the book with a little theology of technology is I want to step back and ask the questions, where does technology come from? And what is God's relationship to technology? I could only flesh those out in a few pages, and I kind of just give a survey in those few pages. And I'm stepping back and kind of working on a bigger, thicker, deeper project that's going to actually ask those questions and press into the questions in a more full way. But I think, number one, we have to recognize that technology is a gift from God. It helps us push back the consequences of sin. It helps us push back the consequences of the fall. So we have medical technology, all types of agricultural technology is helping us to deal with a fallen world in a way that is a gracious gift from God. And so communications technology is part of that. I mean, Even Jonathan Edwards, I was reading in his miscellaneous. So this is 18th century Christian. He's already envisioning a future in which there would be technology to take care of the routine details of life so that Christians across the globe could communicate in real time. I mean, he was already envisioning a Twitter. He was already envisioning a Skype back in the 18th century, which is just amazing to me that Christians were already thinking wow. about this. But these are gifts. These are gifts to draw the global church together in a way that had never, ever, ever been conceived of. And so there's a beauty to technology. There's a wonder to technology. There's also concerns and there's damages in how we use technology in a way that does not honor God. And so I think we have to come to terms with the fact that when it comes to our relationship with technology, it's not easy and simple and clean and clear. There's on one hand a wonder and a praise that we give to God because the technology is here because he makes it possible for us to have an iPhone. The iPhone is not something that humans created ex nihilo out of nothing. The iPhone is not something that aliens beamed at our universe from outer space. I mean, it's a gift that God gave to us. It comes out of creation. And so we embrace it as such, but that does not baptize all the ways in which we use our technology. So I think we have to start, and the only way I can really engage this question is to step back and ask those huge questions of technology, which opens up a lot of several cans of worms to get into debates and things. But that's essentially where I start, is with that premise. Technology is a gift from God, and we can use it for good, and we can misuse it.
That's really good. We work very hard here to help people understand that God made all things, declared all things good. And then the fall has distorted that. And certainly this is why we need to think Christianly, think theologically about our technology. I want to take a rabbit trail. I want to hop off something you said, because you mentioned Jonathan Edwards. Mm-hmm. And one of I think one of the issues that we're seeing in our culture today and even in the church is due to several forces, generational segmentation, which marketing has driven. We classify, we characterize different generations and age groups, and we assign markers. Some of those markers are fair, some of those are incredibly unfair. But one of the trends that I'm seeing practically as I talk to young youth workers and talk to parents is, if someone is not from my generation, if someone is not living and breathing right now as a younger person, there's very little that they can say to us. And so you go back, I just want you to speak to that, because it's interesting to me, it's exciting to me that you're not just consulting with the people who are writing about these things or thinking about these things now, but you're going back in history. What's the value of that? Even talking to a guy 75 years old like David Wells, what's the value in that? What drives you to do that? Just say something about that, because I think that's important.
Yeah, I mean, I would be really uncomfortable as a Christian writer writing anything that does not take into account previous generations of Christian thought or elders today. That would make me really nervous not to bring in seasoned voices from the millennia of church history and recent decades and the recent centuries, but also of the 60 plus, 70 plus men and women in the church who have lived through a lot of revolutions. They've seen a lot of things come and go. There's something, because the gospel is eternal, there's something relevant that gets passed on from generation to generation, no matter how different those generations are. And so we have to listen to the Spirit of God as he's worked through the different generations. That includes David Wells, Jonathan Edwards, Augustine. I mean, there's a lot to learn. And so when it comes to attention and what do we give our eyes to, I've kicked around a book, possibly to write a book in the future on video entertainment. Well, video entertainment is a concern that goes back to the Colosseum in Augustine's day. What do you set your eyes on? What do you look at? It goes back to what the Puritans were wrestling with in London. I mean, there's a Puritan preacher, a fairly famous Puritan preacher who lived in the same neighborhood as Shakespeare, And so there's this huge cultural back and forth. What do you do with a theater? What role does it play? What dangers does it pose? And so as you look throughout church history, you see that these questions of attention, these questions of longings and desires, they are perennial. And so the smartphone is just the latest manifestation of something that grabs our eyes, grabs our hearts. But that's always happened in every generation. You can go back to the four soils. Jesus is talking about distraction back way before the digital media age, way before the media age. People are concerned with wealth and concerned with all of the things that life throws at you, and you can get so distracted that the gospel, like a seed, just gets choked out by the thorns and thistles. So I think when you start to look historically, you start to see these patterns of concern that then make sense of the latest technology. Now, that doesn't mean that it makes the latest technology really easy to discern, because there's still nuances and things, especially when it comes to biotechnology today, is very difficult to discern. But we have a legacy of Christians who have been thinking about these things at some form, at some level.
Mm. Tony, this is really good. We need to take a break. And when we come back, we want to ask you specifically about what you've learned, what you've put in the book, and, you know, how our phones are changing us. So we're going to take a break. Stick with us, and we'll be right back after this. Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture E-Update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture E-Update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked E-Update Sign Up. It's that simple.
Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. We're continuing our conversation on the smartphone and with our guest, Tony Ranke. We're so thankful for you to be here. I want to continue the dialogue that we've had from our first segment. And what I want to be able to find out is, you wrote this book, 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. And I would love to dive into a couple of those elements, points that you made in your book. One of the first ones that I would love for us to be able to discuss was how your cell phone jeopardizes relationship, how it can jeopardize what kind of time you get with family or friends. So maybe if you could dive a little bit into that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the second way. So the 12 ways your phone is changing you. This is number two on my list. We ignore flesh and blood. We ignore the neighbors around us. We ignore our immediate family. We ignore people on the road. So we could talk under this category. We could talk about texting and driving, driving 50 miles an hour down the street, distracted and unconcerned for the person across the street from us that may be separated from us simply by a yellow line in the middle of the road. And we can cause all sorts of damage. But social media itself isolates us to a set of people who are most like us in interest and age. This is something that I discovered as I wrote the book, is just how demographically isolated we become. The people we follow and the people we talk to online, especially among teens, are going to be other teenagers. They're not going to talk to younger kids. They're not going to usually spend much time interacting with older people, definitely not the elderly. And so social media, by its very definition, segments us into our own socioeconomic classes, sometimes gender and race. We just lose a sense of the diversity of the people around us because our social media followers are so much like us in a lot of ways. But again, this is really a perpetual problem that Jesus warns us about over and over a long time ago. And the thing that comes to my mind is the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10. So you have a priest and a Levite who have their minds so consumed with remote ministry possibilities. Those are good things, remote ministry possibilities. What can I do to serve the Lord? That's a good thing. But they have their minds so set on those remote ministry possibilities that they just step over the needy guy who's bleeding out in the gutter of the street. And we're prone to do this very same thing. We ignore the needs that we see at our feet because we have become so enamored with all of the possibilities out in the remoteness of the virtual world. And so I coined the phrase embodied placidness. Embodied placidness. This is neighboring, a concern for people around me. And so when you look at that story in Luke 10, the priest we could imagine the priest is going off to the temple to do his holy duties. He's clean. He's, you know, just took a shower. His clothes are spotless. He can't get dirty with the guy in the street. You've got the Levite who maybe he's late for a preaching gig off in the distance. He can't stop. And so you see the remote possibilities of ministry cloud them from seeing their neighbor right in front of them. And I think digital media does the same exact thing for us today. Texting and driving, again, I think is one of the illustrations here of just not thinking of our neighbor. Again, when Jesus was asked, who is my neighbor? He points to a street because on the street, we're so thoughtless about the people around us. And so you're right. We attend parties and we just sit there staring at our 4-inch screen. We go on a family vacation and we ignore our family and we look at our screens. And at root, our phones push us to evade the limits of embodiment. That's the promise of the iPhone, is that you can escape space and time. You can escape this embodiment to live in the virtual ethereal realm of the virtual world. And God says, no, your body, soul, spirit, you're a holistic being, and you must pay special attention to those people who are in physical proximity to you. And so Jesus in Luke 10 is a great reminder that the people around us have been put in place by God for us to serve them in very real ways. And this, of course, has huge implications for youth ministry and churches and communion and fellowship and you name it. But I think Luke 10 is where I go back to. We ignore our flesh and blood because of the possibilities of what we could do in the virtual space.
Let's talk a little bit about community because people it hasn't been for a long time, but for years have been touting the blessedness of technology and the way that it can enhance community or create community. We've heard a lot about virtual community. But then there were folks like Sherry Turkle at MIT who write a book called Alone Together, where she has great concerns about how technology has undermined flesh and blood presence, like what you're talking about, this embodied placedness. I love that term. And now we are present together, but physically, but not emotionally or perhaps spiritually. So practically speaking, the great irony is that we've got this great tool that can enhance community, but yet it undermines community. Any suggestions for parents or for youth workers on that?
Yeah, I mean, some of the simple things is to get away from the phone, put the phone away and go on youth retreats, digital device free youth retreats. This is, I think, one of the most countercultural things that the church can offer. Not having phones in the car when you're driving around with family, not having phones at the dinner table when you're with family. Those are pretty simple, basic things. But just keeping the phone out of sight, out of mind is really, really helpful in those scenarios. But yeah, technology poses, again, it goes back to this weird conundrum of the benefits and the drawbacks of technology. When we talk about Skype is great. We're talking through Skype right now. I love Skype. I use it every week to meet new people and to get new relationships online and to do interviews and things. It's great. The problem is, for example, if you're doing a Skype conversation or messaging someone with a video app, you can never make eye contact. So if you're looking at the screen, you can look at yourself, which is what we often do, is just stare at ourselves, like, what do we look like to the other person? Or we can see the video of the person we're talking to, or we can stare right into the camera. So those are our three options, but we can never make eye contact. And so when it comes to video messaging, there's always this slight disconnect where we're never really engaged eye to eye. And this has profound implications for the local church and joy. I talk about in the book, there's three references in the epistles where an apostle tells a church, I'm writing you this letter, this epistle, but I can't wait to meet with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. And so when it comes to joy in the local church, that's a face-to-face thing. You can't compensate with a letter. You can't compensate with media on the truest, deepest fellowship that's face-to-face worship together. There's no replacement for that. At the same time, again, you can meet new people online that you would never meet otherwise. One of my best friends is in Canada. He's an Anglican pastor up there. We would have never met had we not used Twitter and blogging and online mechanisms. So it's a pro-con. It's you cannot use social media as a replacement for emotional empathy and things like that. You have to be with a person face to face. There's no replacement for that. And I think what social media does, especially in Facebook, is we're offered this opportunity to watch people's ups and downs and some of the tragedies in the lives of our friends. And we can offer them emojis. I mean, a superficial emoji response of either happiness or sadness, we don't really have to engage emotionally in that. We're just passing through voyeuristically looking at other people's lives. And if we want to interact, it's a contrived emotion. It's not truly deep. It's not felt. It's not communion. And so, again, there's pros and cons, and we have to constantly think through these things. But I think social media is it's convoluting our emotional responses. It's making it too easy. Things come at us too fast. We can't really truly engage with them with the emotional currency that we need to, and it makes us superficial. And that bleeds over. If Facebook is conditioning your relationships with others, when you meet face to face, those same patterns are gonna spill over into your face-to-face relationships. Your emotion is gonna be thin. It's gonna be contrived. It's not gonna be deep, heartfelt. You're not gonna truly carry the burdens of one another. And so, man, we have our work cut out for us.
I want to ask you to comment on this. Let me give you a thought here. We had Donna Freitas on here a couple of months ago, and Donna's written a book called The Happiness Effect. I don't know if you've seen that book or not, but basically, I mean, you know, what she's talking about there is we go out of our way to just, whether we're happy, sad, indifferent, what we have to appear happy. So you talked about how we observe and can track with people's ups and downs. From where you sit, do you see people giving us on social media, curating themselves to put forth more of the ups, even when there aren't even ups to be put there? I mean, they fabricate ups and less of the downs. And just to comment on what that does to us and does to community.
Yeah, well, it depends on the mechanism. So if you're talking about Snapchat, Snapchat is intentionally a moment of time in which you just take a selfie and you connect with someone. It's not edited. It's not filtered. It's just there. It's ephemeral. It's gone. Facebook, Instagram, those are more scrapbooks. So you're putting together an online curated book of images that you want people to see. For a long time, there's been a criticism that people, when they're online, they just want to put their best face forward. They want to shelter themselves behind the best face that they can put. I think that's part of it. But I think what Donna does in her book, The Happiness Effect, which I think is really, really insightful, is she shows that there's a professionalization of social media. So if you're a teenager in high school, you only want to put on Facebook and Instagram things that you know the college that you're looking for, Harvard, Stanford, whatever, they're going to go in and see. So what you're doing is you're putting forward a face that says, I've got it together. I'm smart. I'm confident. I am trustworthy. And so the professionalization of social media, and I do the same thing as well. I mean, I know my employer is looking at everything I post on Twitter. And so there's something in the back of my head that says, you know what? This is part resume, and I want to put forward a picture of myself that is employable, that is confident, that is trustworthy. And what that does, though, is when you have a bunch of curated profiles like that, and then someone goes through a difficulty, a challenge in life, you know, they lose their job and they go to bed at 10 a.m. with a bucket of ice cream, and they're going to watch Netflix and just scan through social media, that just heaps condemnation on them. Because they're comparing their broken life to the put together life that they see curated online. And so, yeah, there's a facade, there's a fakeness to it. I don't think it's always an intentional fakeness that we're just trying to make ourselves look good for other people, but I think there's a professionalization. We want potential schools and potential employers to look at us and see that we have it all together.
Mm. Wow. I want to be able to move from this to one other thing that you talk about, because we're talking about community and we're talking about relationship. I am curious what your thoughts are on where that can go south, because one of the points that you do talk about is becoming harsh to one another. And so I am curious how technology, how the smartphone participates in that.
Yeah. Well, the Bible, again, speaks so much about how we are to relate to one another, how we're to treat one another. And gossip has always been a favorite pastime of sinners who are envious of one another. It just always has been. But now we can text and snap rumors or incriminating evidence against other people to our friends. And on a crystal screen, you know, slinging dirt just seems so easy. It's so hygienic. It's so sanitary. But scripture helps us to realistically see the sinfulness of this impulse to sling dirt and baggage that we have on other people, because we carry that same dirt, that same baggage ourselves, because we're sinners. And so we have to show grace and mercy towards one another. We don't just score points with our friends when we have incriminating dirt on other people. And so contrary to those impulses of online outrage and even cyberbullying, we're called to cultivate a heart of gentle patience as we bear one another's weaknesses and their shortcomings.
You know, that's it's really interesting, because you're talking about the dynamic of – I see this all the time with teens. I see this with adults. The language that happens when it's through text and no face versus in-person, face-to-face, those the language is totally different. Even though there might be a disagreement, the language is different. And so it teaches us – well, what I'm curious is because we have texting, and then you spoke earlier about demographically isolating us. I'm just really curious your thoughts on technology and its participation in the polarization within our country, or even around the world. But I just each of these things, as I think about it, what is your thought when it comes to the idea of polarization and the impact on the way that we're engaging one another outside of social media?
Yeah, some of that is due to algorithms. Last fall, Facebook was accused of favoring liberal news sources over conservative ones. So there's constant debate. If Facebook is going to offer us the news that we want to see, then there's an algorithm that's driving which headlines we see in our feeds. And so there's an algorithm component to this. I think there's just a well, going back to your question or your point about how we tend to be more harsh or use harsher language with our thumbs than we do with our lips. And I think what the smartphone does, and this is something that comes out throughout the book, is I think the smartphone exposes in pixels before my eyes the true deepest longings of my heart. So what it is that I want, the language that I'm going to use, if it's really harsh in a text, that's language that's coming out of my heart for me to see right in front of my eyes on a screen. And so if Jesus says that, you know, every idle word that we speak will be given account for, I mean, we are the first generation in church history to realize that we have published millions of words each. And so there's an accountability, but there's also something sobering about knowing that there's something that we want people to think that we want holy things. We want people to think that our desires are truly holy, but our phones expose the truest, deepest desires of our hearts. What is it that we really want? That approval. We want to be liked. We want to be loved. We want to be accepted. We want to be applauded. We want those things. And so the phone, it gives us a high-definition screen to see all of our wants and our longings and our desires presented right in front of us. And sometimes those desires are lurid. Those are, you know, pornography, materialism, things like that. But the phone is an extension of my heart. And that, to me, is the most sobering thing about this digital technology. The most harsh things that we type with our thumbs that we would never say with our lips is the essence of what's in our hearts. It's exposing us.
That is profound. I love that. You know, just and that's why there was a little bit of silence there, just thinking about that, pondering that, wanting people to ponder that, because for the purpose of self-examination for all of us, and then also to help our kids learn that and see that. You know,
yes.
Jesus said, recorded a couple of times in Matthew, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. And I think the same thing, you know, the thumbs text, the thumbs, you know, post. And
that's right.
And it's just, we've got to realize that. Well, I want to turn
home.
I want to turn the corner and bring this to a close, but not without some practical advice from you. Now, you are a dad, and you've got three kids, and I see here, I don't know their names, but they're all named after dead preachers. I love that.
Most of them are, yeah.
Yeah, so who would those be, just out of curiosity? Can I ask you that?
We've got a Jonathan Edwards, and we've got a John Bunyan.
Okay. All right. So. Great. I won't ask what the third name is.
The third is a girl.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
She got a beautiful Latin name from her mom. But okay. If you're a boy born in our family, I get to name them, and they're going to be a dead preacher.
Okay. That's awesome. I like that. So you've got that deal. That's really neat.
Yeah.
We never made that deal. We never thought about that. Well, let me ask you this. As a dad, knowing what you know, and we love our friend Steve Garber says, now that you know what you know, what are you going to do with it? Now that you know what you know about smartphones and technology, as you've thought theologically and theoretically about this, tell us what you're doing in your home and just give us some wisdom that parents can hear, because we want to know, and youth workers need to hear this too, because they can pass this information on to parents.
Yeah. So I want my kids to be digitally competent and discerning. Mm. I want them to know how to use the web, to know what tools the web offers, while also being consciously aware of the personal tendencies that they have towards digital addiction, and knowing how to navigate the dangers of what the web offers as well. So it's discernment. So beginning with younger kids, we're going to start with a tablet that they can use at home. We didn't really have a moment in time in which a kid could use a tablet. It was just kind of when they showed interest. We would use a tablet for educational purposes. Now we use the Circle device, which is an APR spoofing thing. It's kind of a technology that you can set up in your home that breaks the connection between a website and a device if it's forbidden content or if it's outside of a certain time restriction. And so the Circle device we've used now for a couple of years is really helpful. Again, so that's Wi-Fi and a tablet. And so our kids are going to start on a Wi-Fi and a tablet with limited apps. They're going to be given certain freedoms to use the device educationally, and then for some limited entertainment, for video that's age appropriate. And then, of course, there's restrictions built into the device that we set. The beauty of having the Circle device is it's an independent unit. It's not part of the router, and it's not an app in the device. It's actually a way to break internet connections through one device that manages everything in the home. So all computers, all devices are managed through this device. So you're not setting up parental restrictions on each device necessarily. So that we found that very helpful. Then and there's internet providers now that offer something similar, like Xfinity has something similar. And then at some point, and you're going to have to make this decision based upon your child, based upon your family. At some point, then the smartphone becomes an option. For us, we have held off till age 14 on smartphones, at least for our oldest. He was 14 when he got his smartphone. And what I tell parents is that once you graduate your child to a smartphone, that teen must be prepared to engage with everything that you could imagine that they will see online. Once your teen has a smartphone, they are now open to worlds that are very hard to control. And I know there's certain apps and there's certain plans that you can get with your device that can limit certain features and limit certain content. But once you give a child a smartphone using that with a mobile web, you've now introduced them to way more temptations, and every parent needs to be aware of that. So your child at that point needs to know what cyberbullying is, what it does, and the dangers of it, of receiving it and of dishing it out. Those teens need to know about pornography. They need to know about all forms of materialism that they might be drawn to, and they need to be aware of the unceasing approval culture among their peers that they're going to be engaged in. So it's not just 9 to 3 at school now trying to keep up appearances. Now it's 24/7 as long as they have the phone. They're going to be part of a culture among their peers of trying to appear a certain way. They need to be prepared for that. There's no foolproof protections for this, but you do have to have some conversations with them when you graduate into the smartphone. And then, of course, there's all sorts of regulations that we use, such as your smartphone has to be plugged in to mom and dad's room at 9 p.m. Every school night, and it's 10 p.m. on weekends, things like that. So there's different restrictions that we employ there. But once you make that move to the smartphone, so you go from the Wi-Fi in the home and tablet for younger kids, and at some point you make that break and you move to the smartphone whenever you deem that wise. That's a big change. That's a big step up, and parents need to think through that very carefully.
This is really good. Now, Tony, we're going to recommend, obviously, your book, and we'll include information on that and point people to it, 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. But we always ask this because we love to read and we want to point people to good reading. We want them to learn. Any two or three books that you would recommend beyond yours that you have found really helpful for you personally as you've thought Christianly, thought theologically about the issues of technology and smartphones?
Yeah, so Andy Crouch has a new book called The TechWise Family, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some really good practical advice on how to walk your kids through that digital transition as well. So he's going to be helpful there. I think of my book is really helping parents to discern their own hearts so that they can help their child with their hearts. And so getting at the deeper impulses of what draws mom and dad to their phones, just as what draws the teenager to their phone. So I'm really looking at it from a deeper theological gospel angle. And what Andy Crouch has done is looking at more of the rules and limitations and guidelines of how you walk a child through that transition. So I think his book, I think in Amazon, if you look at my book or his book, our books complement one another, is like the most recently or most commonly purchased book besides this one. We're always one and two together on each page. And so I think they go together really well.
Mm. Good. Well, we'll recommend those. Well, Tony, thanks so much for taking time to be with us. This is really helpful. And
very helpful.
As I say all the time, anyone who's listening, if you aren't listening and streaming from our cpyu.org homepage for Youth Culture Matters, get there, because everything that's been mentioned, including a lot more, we're going to link to some articles that Tony's written that are very helpful, and everything he's mentioned here, we're going to include links to that. So there'll be a wealth of resources there that if you want to go further, and you should on this, think more deeply about this, go there to cpyu.org, hit the Youth Culture Matters page, and look for all the links that are there. So, Tony, thank you. Jason, any final words?
Yeah. No, this was an incredible time. I'm thankful for Tony's insight. So yeah. Thank you for your time, Tony. We really appreciate it.
Jason's Jason's got three young kids, so this is good for him. And I've got four older kids, so this will be helpful with my grandkids. So, all right. Well, thank you, Tony. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Kent. Thanks, Chris, for putting this together today for us. And we'll talk to everyone else again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.